Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow here at Bruegel, and I am joined today by Emmanuel Mourlon-Drole, who has written a really important paper about joint European financing in the context of why do we do this? What are the public goods and the public goals that we try to finance, and how has that influenced what people think is possible, really, since the Second World War? To discuss this paper in its context, we are very fortunate to have Johanna Breuer, an academic from Germany, and Federico Fabbrini, a law professor in Dublin. We are going to hopefully give you some context and some ideas and some ways to think about the financing challenges ahead and put them in the context of what's gone before. Manuel, walk us through your paper, which is it's being read. I have to say, I've been in Frankfurt a lot. People are talking about it there. People are talking about it in Brussels. This has really made a splash. So walk us through what you found and how you put it together.
Well, I wanted to do, I think, essentially three things in setting out this paper. The first was to take a step back from what you mentioned in opening the podcast, the debate on European public goods. The debate on European public goods is an important debate. It's potentially useful to identify criteria to spend at EU level, but it's also very abstract. And what I wanted to do in the paper was to highlight the political bargainings that took place behind the decisions to spend in common. A second reason for doing that paper was that I wanted to offer some wider reflections on the topic that seems to be the precinct of specialists, of economists, of accountants, sometimes of lawyers, who succeed in mastering its very technical procedure. And actually, I think it should not be the case simply because what we spend in common relates to what Europeans want to do together. And this cannot be left to narrow specialists only. And the third reason I wanted to do this paper is that it's true that the historical track record is not favorable for spending in common at European level. Little is spent in common at EU level. If you look at it, it's roughly 1% of the EU's GDP. But as an historian, I think that sticking to that observation obscures many debates that took place in the past. Many debates about spending in common that failed, but that revealed very interesting exchanges between the policymakers. Just to pick up one example that I think should be telling given the international context, let's think about defense. We're having very important debates today about whether or not we should put more money in common for defense. And actually, that was the purpose of something called the European Defense Community that was put forward in the early 1950s. And that did include in the treaty that was eventually not ratified a budget to spend in common. And the logic behind the creation of this budget was not a reflection about economic efficiency. It was a reflection about what Europeans wanted to do in common and to defend themselves in the Cold War world.
Tell us a little more about that. So you said there was a treaty that was not ratified. Did they actually spend anything together or just talk about it a lot?
No, they talked about it a lot. So the treaty was ratified. So that was the six original members of the European Coal and Steel Community in the early 50s. Four member states ratified it, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands and Germany, and Italy and France didn't. And the big issue came from the French government, which had actually initiated the proposal and the treaty and then decided to reject it. The context I was briefly mentioning was the beginning of the Cold War. So Europeans were worried by the potential military threat coming from the USSR. The French in particular were worried by the prospect of German rearmament. And so, to cut a long story short, the solution that came to European policymakers' mind at the time was to create a community of defense where Germany would be rearmed, but through a supranational institution. So technically, Germans wouldn't have been rearmed, so the French were happy, and the six founding members could fight to defense and stand through this new institution.
So interesting. We just did a podcast on German reunification and the time of the Cold War and what it meant to have two different countries in that space, which was within all of our lifetimes and yet seems so long ago. So much has happened. Johanna, you're over there. Tell us where you fit into this research and also what you make of it.
I'm really interested in the budget in general, and that's what I did my PhD about. So where I'm interested is, I think, to kind of take a step away from it and just reconsider what public goods are, because I think we always talk about it, right? But, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you might not have sort of like an immediate reaction to what, you know, you can imagine what a public good is and stuff like that. So I think I'll go back first to the example of a streetlight, right? So a streetlight is a public good, and who benefits from it is actually quite random. But we can make predictions who benefits from it more. And so, you know, you have children walking along the street and they benefit from a streetlight, from this public good. What I think we can all agree on, you know, from our different perspectives, is that we need more European streetlights, right? To go with this example, right? And so this is what I'm interested in, to sort of like, how can we create, or how throughout the course of European integration, how can we make people realize that we need more European streetlights? How can we sort of like create this moment where, you know, where you're thinking about this and you think, oh, okay, this is an example of European solidarity where we can all agree that spending in this sort of area and then having this redistributive effect for everyone, how can it happen? So this is where my interest came from and where this has sort of resulted in my work, because I believe, and this also sort of comes through in Emmanuel's paper, is that there are specific conditions under which it is easier to agree on public goods. And that is, for instance, if you have a moment of European solidarity where everybody feels that this is really necessary. So in one paper, I focused on sort of like workers who were affected by the European Coal and Steel Community's budget, because they received from this budget actual money to create housing, right? So they could live in sort of like better environments with better, I don't know, infrastructure and so on and so forth, right? And that creates a feeling of, you know, this came from the European level, and it makes me feel better in my sort of like daily life experience. And this, I think, we should discuss perhaps later at a later stage in connection to the climate crisis and COVID-19, and this is where Federico did a lot of work on. This is really my interest. How can we, through European public goods, create feelings of European solidarity and community and strengthen the European Union?
Thank you for that. We move now to Federico. You are a law professor, and I will be particularly interested in how you can take us through when European law has actually changed and when it stayed the same, but people have suddenly realized, due to greater need, that something they thought was illegal before is not illegal. And we saw that with the evolution of joint financing from the Greek crisis to the COVID-19 crisis, where some of the things that had been rejected as being legally unsound were now found to be legally okay. How do you see that evolution, and how should we think about it?
First of all, thanks, Rebecca, for having me in the program. I am indeed a law professor, but I am delighted to join this interdisciplinary conversation with friends from history and political science. And I want to start off by congratulating Emmanuel for his paper, because I think he does an extraordinary job in placing an historical perspective the evolution of the EU fiscal capacity. Now, from my standpoint as a law professor, I think a point that Emmanuel makes is very important, namely the fact that you have critical junctures in the history of European integration, which explain big step forward in fiscal integration and the creation of a fiscal capacity. And I think the example of the COVID-19 pandemic that you were referring to, Rebecca, is the case in point. But I would add also the recent response to the war in Ukraine by the European Union confirms exactly that trend. So let me say just a couple of words more about the COVID-19 pandemic. I authored a book entitled, quote, EU Fiscal Capacity, Legal Integration After COVID-19 and the War in Ukraine, unquote, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2022. And as I pointed out in that volume, the EU response to the global pandemic constituted a watershed compared to its prior response to the euro crisis. Specifically, the European Union agreed to establish a massive recovery fund called Next Generation EU, which has, from a legal point of view, three highly innovative features. First, the European Union, and specifically the Commission, is empowered to issue bonds for a value close to 1 trillion euros, raising resources in the financial market. Secondly, the European Commission is empowered to transfer the largest chunk of this money to member states as grants and another part of this money to member states as loans. And then third and finally, as part of the Next Generation EU package, the European Union has also agreed to introduce new so-called own resources, which basically means European taxes, to repay the collective debt. Now, that constitutes a significant step forward in fiscal integration, if you will, a big step forward in fiscal federalism in the EU, because the Next Generation EU Recovery Fund effectively doubles the size of the European budget and creates real European resources, because they are not funded by member state transfers, but they're really money that the EU raises on the financial markets as a union. This is an important precedent that, in a way, fulfills dreams of years and generations past, as Emmanuel was saying earlier, and as Ioana was pointing out too. In earlier days of the European integration projects, efforts were made to significantly strengthen the European fiscal capacity, but until COVID-19, we didn't get to that point. And certainly, creative interpretation of the law was crucial to achieve that goal. Everything was done within the framework of the existing treaty, simply through a new construction of the European legal basis. And I'll just close off by pointing out that the precedent set by the EU responses to the pandemic has now been used as a template to address Russia's aggression of Ukraine. The EU has taken a strong stance in supporting the Ukrainian government and armed forces in repelling Russia's aggression. And since 2022, in the last 3 years, the European Union has effectively raised another 100 billion euros of common debt, which has been transferred to Ukraine in tranches through various programs and mechanisms. But I think this confirms a growing trend of consolidation of the EU fiscal capacity. So the only point where I might disagree with Emmanuel, he seems to be pessimistic in his paper on the potentials of the EU to integrate. I tend to see the glass half full, especially in light of the developments of the last few years.
Thanks for that. When I was writing my book about the European Stability Mechanism, we saw the evolution of the European attitudes toward this, because the very same legal mechanism they're using to leverage the EU budget to borrow on public markets now at scale was really held in by legal opinions at the time. And so they came up with several different intergovernmental ways to borrow on capital markets, which came with intergovernmental consequences for public finances and for the infrastructure of how to raise that money. So the evolution of a real borrowing capacity just as a piece of infrastructure is remarkable, leaving alone the financing. As we move into the next section of our podcast, Emmanuel, can you give us some of the highlights from the 70s and 80s that helped us get through to the EU that we know today, which really goes back to, I'll just pin it to the evolution of the euro and the coming of monetary union. Like, just briefly, what were the key turning points there and how did they set us up for where we got to?
Well, since we're talking about the borrowing capacity, let me give a few examples on this. It's true, obviously, that the borrowing capacity of the EU has, by all means, incredibly changed in recent years with Next Generation EU. But actually, the fact that the EU and its predecessor, the European Economic Community, borrows on international capital markets is not something new. It started precisely in the 1970s in a first step, because there was a technical problem. There were some balance of payments issues between the member states. And so the Commission created, and the member states created, the first mechanism that allowed the Commission to borrow on international capital markets for balance of payment purposes. But let's forget that, because that's very technical. Then the second one that was much more interesting was called New Community Instrument. And it's interesting for two reasons. First, because in terms of principle, of spirit, this is the first example of borrowing at the EU level. The European Collective Community was doing it, but that was in a different context. First example of borrowing at EU level in 1978, from 1978. And the second interesting element is that the reason why it happened was also related to monetary issues and to the making of economic and monetary union. The context was the following. So in 1978, there were negotiations about the creation of the European monetary system, an exchange system for the different currencies of the European Economic Community. And alongside the discussions about the exchange rate system, some member states in the Commission were saying, well, if we only look at exchange rate fluctuations, we won't have any system that will be viable and that will last very long. We need also some economic cooperation agreements, and we need also some fiscal intervention. And the new economic community instrument arrived in that context. The idea was that the Commission would borrow on international capital markets for specific projects of investment in some of the member states that needed it most. So, of course, the amounts of money involved were incredibly small, and even more so compared to Next Generation EU. But in a sense, you have the seeds of the discussion we're having now, namely the EU level can borrow money, and this is in the context of economic and monetary union. So what do we do when member states lose the adjustment possibility with the exchange rate? Do we try to develop a fiscal capacity at EU level? Yes, there were discussions and there were attempts at the beginning there. A third element, I think, and I will stop there, that is important in that whole story, is that the new community instrument was every time agreed for a specific amount, a ceiling, very low usually, and that lasted a few years. So there were four iterations of the new community instruments. And every time there was an important discussion, because that was not a permanent instrument, there was an important discussion between particularly the Commission and the European Parliament. Why? Because the European Parliament was saying, we want that to be a permanent instrument. The member states didn't want that. And already Germany and the Netherlands at the time didn't want that to become permanent because they were afraid of common borrowing at EU level. But the European Parliament was also insisting on something that is very important in the context of fiscal capacity of the EU, which is the democratic accountability of the system. And the Parliament was saying, we want that to be permanent because if it is permanent, then it will be, that was the technical word, budgetized. And so as a consequence, the Parliament would have a say in the spending and the audit of the scheme. But I think we can say, unfortunately, that didn't work out. And the scheme was abandoned, and there was no question of parliamentary oversight on the plan.
Can you help us think about the role of democracy at the EU versus the national level? We've seen with many of these budgetary measures that national parliaments have been very involved in approving them, which is kind of weird that national parliaments in one country could have so much influence over all of the EU. But at the same time, it does give individual countries a lot of ownership over these policies because the people are voting on them and their legislators are voting on them at home, not just in Brussels. I mean, how do you see that?
This is a very complex issue, and I'm sure Federico and Johanna will have plenty of things to complement what I'm going to say. We could actually literally do another podcast on this question. I think it relates at the heart on the perennial question of distribution of powers and responsibility between the different member states, the governments, and the parliament. Whether or not we transfer more powers to the European Parliament, how national parliaments are involved. And in the end, it boils down to the question of to what extent member states are ready to relinquish some parts of their sovereignty in the decision-making process. And that's why it's so debated, and that's why it's so difficult institutionally, politically to solve.
It is really hard. Federico, I want to bring you in here and also either tacked onto this or as a follow-up, I want to ask you about the role of national courts, because we've seen the German Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe has had some very influential rulings and things to say in this area. We've seen courts in Estonia and other member states also weigh in. So how do you see this balance between the EU and the national levels in terms of accountability?
Well, I'll try to answer that question, Rebecca, through a comparative perspective, because I think that helps us illuminate the challenges that Europe faces. But these challenges are not unique. In many ways, there are typical constitutional challenges of federal systems. Now, the F word in Europe is sometimes seen as threatening, but the reality is that if we consider federalism simply a mechanism to divide powers between states and a supranational organization, then the European Union is facing exactly the same difficulties that other unions of states have had historically. The case of the United States comes obviously to mind, and in my book that I was mentioning previously, I also have a comparative chapter looking at Europe and the United States in comparative perspective. The United States started off as a very loose confederation where budgetary and fiscal powers were effectively only exercised by the separate states, but because of external and internal threats over time, but it took 250 years to get there, the United States integrated its fiscal federalism and the federal government acquired a growing amount of powers. The Swiss case also could be mentioned in this respect as another example of a confederation that, because of needs, has eventually ended up transferring some, but not many, in fact, in the Swiss case, fiscal powers to the central government. Europe, in some ways, is exactly along that path. What justifies the transfers of fiscal power from the states to the union? Here, I want to emphasize another great point that Emmanuel makes in his paper. And the point is that economic rationale alone is not a good explanation for why powers are transferred from the states to the union. You can't make sense of fiscal integration simply on the basis of abstract rational economic arguments. Really, it's history, it's politics, it's societal developments, and so on. And if I may just conclude on that point, what I think is interesting, you were asking me about this earlier as well. The response of the European Union to the COVID-19 pandemic and fiscal integration that has happened since 2020 is very different from the response to the euro crisis a decade before. How do we explain that? And I think there are at least three arguments that, in my view, led in 2020 to NGU and didn't lead to a similar fiscal capacity a decade before. First of all, the COVID-19 pandemic was largely a symmetric crisis. Of course, COVID impact wasn't exactly the same everywhere, but more or less everyone was affected. That was certainly not the case back in 2010 when the euro crisis hit. Some countries were really hit and others ultimately ended up benefiting of it. Secondly, the COVID-19 pandemic was an exogenous crisis. It was coming from outside the EU, whereas the euro crisis was, at least in the narrative, presented as an endogenous crisis, as being generated by reckless public spending in Greece. We could obviously discuss whether that was true, but certainly that was the dominant narrative. And then the third element that, in my view, as I argue also in my book, explain the different response to COVID compared to the euro crisis, is that I think from a moral perspective, it was hard not to do something. The audience everywhere in the world will remember when in February, March 2020, graves were being piled up in northern Italy, one of the epicenter of the pandemic. And, you know, even if you are fiscally conservative, it's really hard not to do something to respond to such a unjust crisis that hits a country for no reasons of its own. And I think these three arguments together led to fiscal integration. Now, you can easily apply the same three arguments to Russia's aggression of Ukraine. This is a crisis that affects everyone in Europe because of the rising cost of energy. This is a crisis that is exogenous. It's been led by Putin's reckless war of aggression against Ukraine. And again, it's a morally repugnant crisis. When Russia bombs hospitals and schools, you have to do something. And that's why, as I said, in the last couple of years, the EU has really upped its fiscal tools to address the war in Ukraine.
That's such a good point about the external nature of the COVID threat. And also, though, there's the lessons of the euro crisis and that they tried other ways to borrow and they weren't as good. The The fact that the euro area had borrowed together in several other ways on markets and gotten lower rates and poorer ratings than they, in some cases, would through really using the EU budget showed them that it was in their interest to do this. It was in their financial interest. Johanna, is that something your work has talked about, just the interaction of borrowing costs and these political decisions? We've already heard from Manuel that in the beginning it was France that wasn't sure about the public budgets, but of course Germany has been the chief skeptic for recent decades. How do we think about all this?
I mean, I don't know. My problem is a little bit that I really disagree with Federico about this sort of like argument that we are on a federalization path. So maybe I can start here, right? Because, you know, all the examples that Emmanuel gave earlier, those are all temporary instruments, and NGO is also a temporary instrument. So, you know, in my work, I actually argue that the EU budget is a transfer budget. It's unlike the budget of nation states because it primarily organizes transfers between some sectors and some economies and, you know, the agricultural sector, for instance. That's the best example. Right. So I'm actually very hesitant about sort of like seeing the sort of like federalization future and how quickly, you know, in sort of if we have, let's just imagine we have another financial crisis where one country has done reckless spending, financial crisis number two, right? I don't think we would be able to agree on further fiscal integration in that same way as it happened during NGU, right? So, you know, I really, you know, I'm very hesitant about this.
It makes a lot of sense. And one of the things I work on in bond markets and financial stability, one of the ways I think about that is separating borrowing capacity and bond market infrastructure from spending decisions, because spending decisions, as you point out, are very pulled into this. Can you help our listeners get a little more political context about the different member states and why they feel the way they do and how that affects the decisions that are made?
No, I mean, with the budget, we sort of see different camps across the EU, right, with spending decisions. So we have the northern camp, we have the southern camp. Sometimes we have sort of smaller coalitions between Eastern European states and Western European states, but it's all sort of, you know, even if the coalitions sort of change slightly during different multi-financial framework negotiations, we always stuck in a juste retour mechanism, right? And so every time, you know, you have any sort of discussions about fiscal spending, you're always stuck in a juste retour argument. And this juste retour argument, you know, getting as much out of the budget as you're putting in, you know, trying to see how much you benefit, how much you lose, right? That is actually something that has existed since the 1950s. So we see that throughout the course of European integration, but over time it became sort of politicized, right? So, you know, if you think about fiscal spending, you know, from an outsider who's maybe not so much interested or keeping tabs on this topic, you see very little change. You always see very strong path dependencies, you know, always sort of like just trying to make out how much you lose out financially. It's not a community budget. It's a budget of transfers. So this is really like sort of like what I want to get across from a political science perspective here, how sort of like how stringent and how inflexible this whole, you know, this whole fiscal capacity aspect is on the European level.
It's so interesting to hear you frame it like that, because for me, having come from the United States, a budget of transfers and a budget of community are very much seen as the same thing. And it's been my experience that national budgets are also run along those lines. You see wealthier regions in countries support the less wealthy regions. But when it goes across international borders, it is a different case, and we don't have the treaty for a permanent EU debt yet. This podcast is helpful for Bruegel because it's the first time in a while we've really dug into the political side of it as opposed to the financial market side of it. We spend a lot of time talking about safe assets. Great topic. We'll do more podcasts on that. But it is really good to revisit, like, what do we do together and what are we not doing together? As we head into the last section of our podcast, we want to come back to what is the point of this borrowing and where do we go from here? Federico, get us started.
Thanks, Rebecca, for calling me back in. I just wanted to add a few words about the interesting exchange with Johanna about the fiscal integration path. And I think It's interesting because she's actually making a correct legal argument. Technically, we don't have a permanent fiscal capacity. Next Generation EU is by design created with an end date in 2026. But I think it's important we don't underestimate the power of path dependency. So I'll be making here a political science argument, which is really Ioana's expertise. And I think it's interesting that notwithstanding the political rhetoric on the temporal dimension of the EU fiscal responses to COVID-19, in reality, what we have seen in the last 3 years is really a greater ease by the EU in issuing common debt. And this is not state transfer. This is, again, resources that the EU raises as a union on the financial market. A totally different question is whether the EU will be able to repay that debt. We still don't have really the fiscal resources, the taxation powers that would be needed to repay over 1 trillion euros of common debt. But politicians seem to be unhindered by that challenge, and they seem to be getting on pretty easily at issuing debt. This is often not publicized very much in the political discussion. But as I said, since 2022, in the aftermath of Russia's aggression of Ukraine, the European Union has already issued over 100 billion euros of common debt to raise resources and transfer this through Ukraine. Many of these resources are technically designed as loans. The EU gives money to Ukraine and expects Ukraine to pay it back with an interest. But realistically speaking, given the circumstances of the war and the fiscal challenges that Ukraine faces, it's very likely that the loans will be forgiven. And therefore, this will turn effectively into grants. And that will further add pressure on the European Union to find the resources to pay back creditors on the financial market. But what is really interesting is the easiness with which the European Union has reproduced the NGU model at least half a dozen times with the macrofinancial assistance instruments for Ukraine, the Ukraine facility, other special purpose vehicles designed to help Ukraine, and now a new regulation where the European Union is also using Russian central bank frozen assets as a guarantee to repay back part of the loans it's raising on the financial market.
That is such an interesting case because legally, from a bond market collateral perspective, there's no direct guarantee from this interest. If the assets get unfrozen and the interest stops, the EU is still on the hook for the debt. So the EU is sort of self-guaranteeing there. But it does play into this question of own resources. And I want to come back to that with Emmanuel because it's going to help us going forward. Politically, there's this commitment for new own resources and people have this idea of, oh, we'll use a carbon tax or a transaction tax or something like that. But functionally, it's a lot more economically efficient to just raise the national contributions and let the member states figure out how to pay for it rather than trying to implement a new tax and all of the bureaucracy and cost of administrating that. Emmanuel, from all of these experiences that you've put together, how much is this political tension between the economically easiest way to do something and the politically feasible way of doing something? I mean, do they take turns? Sometimes one of them is more ascendant than the other. Where do you see it?
I think both happens a little bit at the same time. We covered in the discussion so far the two elements under, I think, different phrasings, if you like. Johanna was insisting on the questions of the juste retour, so the notion of fair return. If you put 100 in the pot, you get back 100. And Federico also insisted on the question of the triggers. Actually, both insisted on the question of the trigger, whether it's an external crisis that triggers the decision to spend in commons, or whether it can be something else. How do the two interact? The political dimension, the economic dimension, through these two key questions, the trigger and the juste retour, that take turns and they come into the discussion all the time. There is, I don't think, any necessity in trying to distinguish one from the other. If you think about the example I provided earlier, which was about the new community instrument, that was both an economic rationale, helping countries that would join a tight exchange rate system, and this was also a political one, in the sense they wanted the European economic community to function, and for that to happen, they needed to support the weaker member state. If we think about the European Defence Community that I mentioned at the very beginning and that was not ratified, that was a little bit the same. That was both the political rationale and an economic rationale. If you think about other examples, European regional policy, if you think even about the common agricultural policy, it's both an economic reason and a political reason. What I think would be useful to distinguish rather, coming back to the debate about European public goods, is when we talk about an economic reason and when we talk about a debate about economic efficiency. An economic efficiency is a very different thing from just an economic rationale. Economic efficiency is what the European public goods debate illustrates very well and contributes to very importantly. A sort of rational calculation about where you spend, whether it is at national level or at European level, where you have trade-offs, economic trade-offs, financial trade-offs, where it is actually more efficient, more cost-effective to spend. This is very different from saying there is an economic rationale behind a decision to spend. You can, for instance, argue that there are problems in the common or in the single market, that it gives more advantage to some regions and that other regions will be disadvantaged. And then from an economic perspective, you say, well, let's provide some support to disadvantaged regions. But then you don't go into the details about how the money is spent in these disadvantaged regions. And the result can be, so to say, under an economic efficiency argument, be completely inefficient. And that's one of the criticisms that is made sometimes for investments in regional policy or investments in the common agricultural policy. So I think actually, rather to close on that, rather than economic versus political, it's probably a finer understanding of an economic rationale, which exists in the debate about public spending at EU level, and a narrower understanding of economic efficiency, which is much different.
This has been such a great discussion. And listeners out there, I hope you will go read Emmanuel's paper, look up Johanna's paper, Federico's book, all of the other writing at Bruegel about safe assets and common spending and fiscal rules. There's such a rich debate out there. As we bring this conversation to a close, I'd like to go back through our speakers and just hear from each of you maybe a little bit of a prediction, if you dare, or an analysis of where we're going to go in this next institutional cycle. Johanna, would you like to start?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you. So I actually think that, you know, the climate crisis will challenge Europe in sort of like a fiscal way, in such a way that we might see small funds that become permanent to help each other out. I think that will have a real European, you know, benefit of solidarity. And, you know, here that will inevitably lead to human suffering, you know, the upcoming floods and, you know, rising temperatures and so on and so forth, you know, air pollution and so on, loss of biodiversity. That there, you know, we can perhaps, you know, cherish the European budget, make it more flexible, make it more sort of creating European public goods for, you know, sustainable European societies.
A famous Irish poet once said, it's very hard to make predictions, particularly if they concern the future. So I need to be very reluctant in answering that question, Rebecca, but I welcome that you try to push us to think and anticipate what's going to happen. I'll start off by saying something obvious, and here I agree with Johanna. There are major challenges and constraints towards fiscal integration in Europe in the future. That's an obvious fact. There are legal and political obstacles towards the strengthening of European fiscal capacity. But I tend to see the glass half full, to be honest. And it seems to me that if you read the recent reports by Enrico Letta and Mario Draghi, there is increasing pressure to increase the fiscal capacity of the European Union. And in my view, the real trigger will probably be the re-election of Donald Trump to the White House in the United States, because something we can easily predict will happen, because Trump has been open about it, is that the United States will disengage from European defense. And that will effectively bring us back to the heydays that Emmanuel was discussing at the beginning of the podcast, when in the 1950s, Europe created a European defense community to basically take care of its own defense. And yes, guys, militaries are expensive. So if we want to become serious, if Europe wants to take up the challenge of defending itself at a time when Pax Americana might be waning, then I would think that is an area where fiscal integration, common borrowing, common spending will become important again. And who knows, we might even revive the European Defense Community Treaty to that purpose.
Well, let me try to conclude on a also slightly optimistic note, especially at the time of closing this podcast. But I'm trying to see the situation with the glass half full, as Federico did. I think there were three central challenges to this whole debate about common spending: the question of the trigger, the question of the fair return, the juste retour, and the question of the democratic accountability of the framework. We have a trigger, Federico mentioned it. So we can hope that this is an opportunity to revisit the question of the juste retour and address it in a more, long story short, federalist way, where there is less interest in trying to see how much someone puts into the pot and how another member state may get out of the pot. And that in the end, the democratic accountability is also improved and the role of the parliament in the whole discussion of the budget is more important. And of course, this is a very important challenge, but so long as the member states of the European Union are not ready to confront the key issue as to how much power they are ready to transfer to the EU level, and how much they are ready to give up with this juste retour mentality, there is no progress in sight. And maybe the election of Trump will offer that.
So much to think about. Thank you very much, Federico Fabbrini, Johanna Breuer, Emmanuel Morland-Roll. You can find their full bios and links to their papers on our website, Bruegel.org, where you can also find the archives of this podcast. It's available on all your favorite listening channels. We thank you so much for joining us today on The Sound of Economics, and we'll see you next time.